This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Today on Keeping the Faith, we're talking with a medical doctor, Norma Price from Arizona. Norma, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Good. Now, you're in Arizona, but I can tell just from those words you have a southern accent. Explain to me how this happens.
I moved to Arizona 14 years ago from Atlanta, Georgia. And I grew up in Mississippi and did part of my schooling there and part of my schooling in Tennessee and then some postgraduate work in Texas. And then I practiced medicine in Atlanta for 25 years. So until I moved out here, I pretty much stayed in the South.
Now, we're talking with you today about a group called the Samaritans that you're part of. Tell me and our listeners what the Samaritans do in that part of Arizona.
We are very close to the border. We're 60 miles north of the Mexican-Arizona border, and we're right at the edge of the Sonoran Desert. And migrants cross through here, people coming north, mostly from Mexico, but many from Central America as well, and they're coming to for work, and sometimes many of them are coming to reunite with families. We have mothers and children coming to be with their father and husband, and some children that the parents have been working up here for years and finally saved up enough money to pay someone to bring their children. So we have these people coming north all the time, and when Samaritans was first started, it's because so many people were dying in the desert. And now over 200 people die every year. And we our work is to try to stop the death.
You mentioned that 200 people die each year trying to cross into the United States from the southern border. Do you have any idea how many make it? How many actually are coming to this country not through the legal channels?
We can only extrapolate, and it changes, of course, and of course we don't have any accurate numbers. It's estimated from the number of apprehensions. In the past, there have been over 400,000 apprehended a year crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. This past year, been more like 100,000 because of the effects of the U.S. economy and not as many jobs available, so not as many people come. So many people that do come north to work in the past have come because a relative or friend said, there's a job for you if you come up here. You know, an employer would say, do you have a relative or friend? We need two more people working in this particular situation. But with the economy here in the States like it is, jobs have not been available. Fewer people have been coming, and then actually people have been going back home because of loss of jobs. So we don't know how many make it, but we know that there are many more than those that are apprehended.
Now, as a medical doctor who practiced so many years, what was your specialty, by the way?
I started off in medical oncology, which I practiced first, and after medical oncology, I worked in urgent care, and I worked in urgent care for 11 years, and that helped, at the time, of course, I didn't know it, but that helped prepare me for what I'm doing now, because it gave me a broad spectrum of first aid and taking care of immediate problems that you didn't have time for long-term follow-up.
Tell me what you do. What do the Samaritans do?
Initially, back in 2000, in 98, if you look at the numbers of deaths. In 98, you started seeing people dying in the desert, and the number increased every year. It more than doubled. And so in 2000, Humane Borders was formed, which started putting water in the desert in set places. The number one medical thing we see is dehydration. So everybody out there needs water. And, in fact, this is a statistic that the human body in the desert, in a condition of exertion, loses 15.5 liters of fluid a day. And there's no way that you can carry enough water from the border to where a person will be picked up to replenish that loss. So the number one thing we do is provide water. But after Humane Borders was started in 2000, then in 2002, the death toll continued to rise, and it was going up every year. So Samaritans was started to, in addition, putting out water to take medical people into the desert. And whereas Humane Borders had these stationary water stations at strategic points along the trails, these were 55-gallon tanks, so they couldn't be moved easily or without heavy equipment. Samaritans drive the roads, the back roads. We have four-wheel drive vehicles. We drive the back roads. We get out and hike the trails and hike in the arroyos, and we carry medical aid, and then we also carry water, gallon jugs and smaller containers of water, and food packs. So that was our initial approach in 2002. But the death toll continued to be elevated. And so in 2004, No More Deaths was started. And No More Deaths and Samaritans work very closely together. And what No More Deaths does that's different from what we were already doing is they have a camp out in the desert that we staff with volunteers, and it's about 10 miles north of the border. And it's in a location, it's on private land, but it's in a location where a lot of migrants come through. So from the 1st of June until the end of September, it's staffed by volunteers. A lot of students from all over the country come and spend a week or a month or all summer there. And they then, from that base camp, go out and hike and look for people who are in trouble and carrying water and then also bandaging blisters, wrapping sprained ankles or knees, or calling 911, which if there's a serious medical problem, we call for medical evacuation and call the medics to come get them.
Now, by picking the name Samaritans, who was involved in starting this, and were they somehow motivated by religious or faith motivations?
Yeah, it's an offshoot of, I guess you would say the origin is in the same spiritual community that was part of Sanctuary back in the 80s. Actually, we meet in the Southside Presbyterian Church, which was where the Sanctuary movement got started. We consider that it's faith-based, but it's not a religious group. I mean, they're people of all different religious denominations and religious beliefs, or none involved, but we all have the calling to go in and help the person who's fallen in the ditch, like the Samaritan who was beaten up by robbers. And that's how the name, of course, was chosen from the New Testament parable that Jesus told about the Good Samaritan who helped the man who was beaten up by robbers.
And in terms of your work, are you paid or are you volunteers?
Totally volunteer. Yes, Samaritans has, and we really don't have any hierarchical structure. I mean, there's no chairman or president. It's We have different facilitators at the meetings, and people trade out jobs as far as scheduling trips into the desert or taking care of the vehicles. We have one man who fortunately is so good at taking care of the vehicles because nobody else wants to do that or knows how. And so it's pretty loosely structured, but I think we're all united by the desire to do something to help people who are in need.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Dr. Norma Price, a medical doctor who's been a volunteer with a group called the Samaritans in her section of Arizona, helping people who are migrants who are coming to this country across the border. If you'd like to join this conversation, ask a question, make a comment, all we ask is that you keep your comments or questions relatively short so our guests can talk and other people can call in as well. The number in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois area, if you're in the 217 area code, punch in 333-9455. If it's a long-distance call, punch in 1-800-222-9455. So in the local regional calling area, 217-333-WILL, long-distance, 1-800-222-WILL. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs. I'd like to thank Don Nolan for filling in for me last week when I was at a meeting in Chicago, and appreciate him doing the interview last week. I'm going to be here a couple weeks, so happy to be talking today with Norma Price. Norma, how long have you been a volunteer with the Samaritans?
Since the beginning.
From 2002?
Yes, uh-huh.
And what caused you to move to Arizona from the southeast?
Well, the weather. I like the warmer weather out here, and the hiking's wonderful, and my husband and I do a lot of outdoor activities, and we're not limited by cold weather. So,
now, are you still practicing medicine in other ways than as a volunteer?
I volunteer only as a volunteer, but in addition to Samaritans, I volunteer at a clinic for uninsured, which is in South Tucson.
When you first started, when you joined this group, how many others were there who were interested in this, who were involved, and how many are there now?
Well, there when it started, of course, Humane Borders was already had been functioning for over a year, and Humane Borders, the group that puts out these huge water tanks, they first met in the Quaker Meeting House, and there were a lot of people of all, as I mentioned before, of all different denominations and religions involved. When Samaritans started, I had gone out with Humane Borders, and at that time when I went out with Humane Borders, someone mentioned, well, tomorrow's the first training for Samaritans, so I went to that meeting. There must have been 70 people in the room, and that was the beginning of Samaritans. Now, not all of those people are able to go out into the desert because some help in other ways, preparing food packets, preparing water jugs to go out, doing other things. And it's been a state of flux. Not everybody who was involved initially is involved today. We have a listserv of over 300. But I think of the active members, it's probably about 70. And that changes. It's not the same 70 for a very extended period of time. It may be some different ones will come in and somebody will move away.
Now, is this an informal group, or do you have a nonprofit status? Do you have people who donate to you?
We are dependent on donation for all of our expenses. And, you know, people volunteer their time. But the the food packs we put out, upkeep of the vehicles, and our vehicles have been donated, but they still require upkeep. It's through the tax-free status is through Southside Presbyterian Church. So it is a 501c3 organization because of its connection with Southside Church.
Now, why would church people, or whether they're Quakers, Presbyterians, or whatever, be involved in helping people who are entering the country illegally?
Well, we don't distinguish who the human rights of any individual. In spite of the fact that they are unauthorized in their entry, they're good people who are just coming to work and are, you know, have no malintent, and we can't sit by while 200 people, more than 200 people, die every year. Whatever the status of their residency, you can't just see in the newspaper people dying and not do something about it.
Is what you as Samaritans do in providing medical care, help, food, water, so forth, is that illegal?
Nothing we do is illegal. It is not illegal to give food or water or to help someone. If we were putting them in our vehicle and taking them to some other place, either taking them to Phoenix or taking them to bringing them to Tucson from the desert, or if we were taking them to Los Angeles, that would be a different category. But what we do is not illegal because we don't do that. We just treat them, wish them well, give them water, and if they're not able to continue, then we call 911, or sometimes they'll ask us to call Border Patrol because they realize that they can't continue. Either they're lost or they're not physically able to continue, and they want to go back. And so they'll ask us to call Border Patrol. But we don't do anything that's against the law.
Now, about a month ago on This American Life, a program, a national program that is heard right after this program, in fact, on Sundays and also on Saturdays here on WILL, but heard around the country. On This American Life about a month ago, there was an interview, sort of a magazine article like they have, with people who were also in Arizona, but who were trying to be sort of vigilantes and stop these people from coming across the border. One of the things they played on that radio program, This American Life, was a conversation that one person was having from his pickup truck to someone else about your organization, about the Samaritans, and here they come again, you know, taking water. Are we following them, or are they following us? Did you happen to hear that program?
I'm so sorry. I missed that. Well, I hope I can find it online.
Well, they have archives, so do go to the This American Life and look for that.
I'm
sorry. I don't have the date, but it was I had not heard you speak yet, and so I just enjoy. I heard that there was this group called the Samaritans. That's how I heard about it, and then heard you speak when you were in Illinois.
So it was before I was there.
Okay. I think it was before you came and spoke here in Illinois.
Okay, that'll help me find it.
I may be right, but I'm getting elderly and my memory isn't very. So let's talk a little bit about what you encounter. Can you give us some examples of people that you have met and their stories?
That's interesting. And you mean migrants that I've met?
Yes, migrants.
Vigilantes.
No. or either one, actually.
Well, I can say a few things about vigilantes, factual. I don't want to stray from that. But the people we've met, I think you know from having, you and I having met when I was there, that we have a book about the stories of people we've met. It's called Crossing with the Virgin, Stories from the Migrant Trail. And it's published by the University of Arizona. And you can go online, either University of Arizona Press or crossingwiththevirgin.com. There are excerpts and pictures from the book. And it can be ordered from Amazon, just for more stories than I can tell here. But I don't want to start rambling, but some of the stories are just so amazing. One of the stories that comes to mind is a man who came up to look for his daughter. She had been left behind by her group, and he was from Zacatecas, and she was with two children. She was not able to keep up with her group, and so her son stayed with her, but she talked the group into taking her daughter. They were going to meet the husband and father in Texas, and she died of dehydration in the desert. And the father came up to look, and he contacted his, meanwhile, his grandson, the son of the woman, went to try to get help, and the Border Patrol, he found the Border Patrol. He tried to get them to go back, and they looked for her but couldn't find her, so they took him back to Mexico. And then when the grandfather came up, he wanted to get the son to go with him because he had seen where she was left, but they wouldn't allow the son to come up. So every day, the father hiked the desert looking for the remains of his daughter, and he took pictures with a disposable camera. And at the end of the day, he would have these pictures developed and go back to Nogales, Mexico, to the grandson, and show him the pictures to see if he identified any of the landmarks. And he continued doing this for 3 weeks. And he had two friends who came to help him search. He had, years ago, worked here in the States himself. And in that three-week period of time, he encountered quite a few groups of migrants. And he would try to help them, give them water, food, or if they needed help, call the Border Patrol for them. And he found remains of three other desert crossers during that period of time. And he finally found his daughter. And at first he didn't know whether, because by that time, of course, the deterioration was pretty far advanced. But he saw a hand near the skull, and on that hand were three rings that she had worn. And so he knew that this was his daughter. And we had a memorial service here before he left. He told his friend, he said, "I know if I find my daughter, if I find Lucretia, that it'll just be bones, but I want to take her and bury her back in her country." And so before he left, we had a memorial service, and then they went back to Mexico. That's one of the stories that always sticks in my mind, because he was such a wonderful man, and we were so sorry that, you know, the whole time he was searching, we knew that the outcome would not be good because of the length of time.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith with medical doctor Norma Price of a group called the Samaritans, a group of volunteers who in near Tucson, Arizona, go out into the desert and provide water and food packs and medical supplies, medical treatment for migrants who have come across the border into the United States. If you'd like to join this conversation, ask a question or make a comment, call us, 333-9455 if you're in the Champaign-Urbana listening area. If it's long distance, for example, if you're listening online, you may call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. And if you've missed part of this program, or I will have to leave before it's finished and want to hear it later, this program will be archived. It's usually up within a couple days. And you can find it at will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith, and leave the G off of keeping, and we're informal, just keeping the faith at the end of will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith. I'm Steve Shoemaker. We're about halfway through this program today. We're talking about migrants and the group called the Samaritans. Next week, we'll be talking with Cliff Jackson. He is in Hot Springs, Arkansas, an attorney there. He has quite a following of things he writes online and on Facebook, and we're going to be talking with him about some of those interesting issues. He describes himself as a Christian agnostic, and we're going to be talking about faith and doubt, and he also uses the word an existentialist Christian. So that should be a fun conversation with Cliff Jackson, attorney from Arkansas, November 20. Coming up on November 27, we'll be having an archive program, a replay of an interview we did last February with Izzeldin Aboulaish, also a medical doctor, a Palestinian from Gaza, whose three daughters were killed in one of the conflicts with Israel. He's written a book called I Will Not Hate, a very interesting book. So we'll be talking about Islam, forgiveness, and peace. This Muslim doctor had quite a story to tell, and you'll be able to hear that again on November 27. Coming up in December, we'll be talking with an author on the 11th of December, Amy Frickholm. She's a regular writer for the Christian Century magazine. She has a new book out called See Me Naked, based on interviews she's done on the topic of sexuality and faith with several interesting people, young people, middle-aged folks, older folks. So, author Amy Frickholm on December 11. Those are some of the programs coming ahead on Keeping the Faith. And let me take just a moment to mention that thank the University YMCA for its continued support for this Keeping the Faith program. At the Y this year, the Friday Forum programs are over. I heard a very good lecture there by former Governor Jim Edgar last Friday. That will be rebroadcast tomorrow night on another community radio station. If you would like to hear that, a very good lecture by Governor Edgar. Also at the Y right now, up until December 23rd, the end of the semester, is a interesting art exhibit called Waveland, a Meditation. A town in Mississippi that was affected by Hurricane Katrina, and it's a very interesting photographic meditation. It's something that's worth sitting and looking at and thinking about. So that's at the University YMCA at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. The Y is on the corner of Chalmers and Wright Street, and you can get there easily by bus, and many times during the week you can even find parking places around there. Okay, back to our guest today, Norma Price. Norma, when you mentioned the book that has a collection of these interesting stories, Crossing with the Virgin, tell us where that title comes from.
The Virgin of Guadalupe is the patron saint of Mexico, and this is the Virgin of Guadalupe is the Virgin Mother who revealed herself to a peasant in 1531 or 1534. I've forgotten the exact date, but because of her grace in revealing herself to this peasant, indigenous boy, she has been revered all these years as the patron saint of Mexico. And so I mentioned that I think undoubtedly the majority of the people who come to the States to work are from Mexico, though we do have a lot from Central America. But they carry with them an amulet with the Virgin of Guadalupe, or the image of Virgin Guadalupe on a T-shirt or a baseball cap or a prayer card. And when we are in the desert, many times we'll find things that have been left behind because either when they were picked up by the Border Patrol, they had to leave their belongings behind, or when they were picked up by their ride, their transportation, they had to leave everything behind. And in the backpacks or in their belongings will find prayer cards with the Virgin of Guadalupe.
And again, that book is published by University of Arizona Press, Crossing Correct. With the Virgin. Who put that book together?
Well, there were three. I was one of three Samaritans who collected the stories. I consider that we are just giving a voice to the migrants who can't tell their stories openly to other people. And, of course, we changed the names of most of the people. The story I mentioned about Lucretia and Cesario, I didn't change those names because it doesn't jeopardize their safety in this country, of course. But there was a story in there about Isabel, who broke one ankle and sprained the other, and how she was found by some Samaritans and then taken to the hospital. She recovered, and eventually she traveled on. Of course, changed her name, but I saw her when she was in the hospital, and we wrote down the stories of these people. And the stories are all true, and some are very inspiring and uplifting, and some are sad, but we felt like we needed to give a voice to these people who can't tell their stories themselves.
When you go back home to where you grew up in the South, what do family and friends think about this volunteer work you're doing to help migrants?
Well, I can't say. I'm sure, you know, people in the South try to be just as polite as they can, so they probably wouldn't tell me. They would just totally ignore me if they didn't approve. But my family is very supportive of our work, very much so, and most of my friends. And I'm sure there's some acquaintances that I've had in the past who maybe don't see eye to eye with what we're doing, but I don't see how you can turn your back on people who are in danger of dying and people who need your help. It's hard for me to see that. But my friends and family are very supportive. Very supportive.
Let me share a little information with you and with our listeners. Our good technical director, Cal Crow, has at my request, searched for that This American Life program that I heard a while back. And it's episode 442 of This American Life. You can find that at thisamericanlife.org/radio-archives, episode, and then /442, and this one happened to have been called Thugs, and so you can see what they think of the vigilantes who are trying to oppose your work.
Well, you know, I mentioned that we put out gallon jugs of water because even though Humane Borders has these huge tanks of water, these water stations that are 55-gallon tanks, and there'll be two, sometimes three at a site. We know that the trails that the migrants follow change, and so that's one of the reasons that Samaritans started driving the back roads and hiking the trails. So both No More Deaths and Samaritans puts out these gallon jugs of water, and unfortunately we find instances where they've been slashed with a knife or some kind of sharp instrument. And we do have videos of some people who've done that, but, I can't say that it's vigilantes all the time, but we always wonder if it is. It's certainly people who are not in favor of what we're doing.
Let's talk about the politics a little bit. I know you think about that. currently there's a big wall. What's the effect of that wall?
Oh, you know, I've had Border Patrol say that it slows people down 5 minutes. And the wall has, we had a book reading at one of the bookstores, Crossing with the Virgin, and there was an 86-year-old lady there, and she listened to the stories, and then afterwards, this was just before one of the elections, and she said, she called one of our local politicians by name and said, he wants to build more walls. She said, have they quit building ladders in Mexico? And we do see ladders where people have backed up a truck to the wall and gotten on a ladder and climbed over. I've never seen anyone climbing over, but I've talked to people who have. And the wall has different configurations at different places along the border. From you can see in San Diego where the wall goes all the way out into the Pacific. And then and it's solid. Sometimes it's made out of the solid metal. But the new wall here along the Arizona border is these pipes that are filled with concrete, and they're, oh, I don't know, 6-8 inches apart, maybe more. But one man told me that he just put his knees between these spaces and just climbed up the pole. So it, the wall is not effective. It, you know, people still are crossing over. I think the thing that has slowed down the number of migrants coming is the economy here in the U.S.
Should there be a limit on immigration?
Well, of course, there is a limit. If you go to the government website and look under visas and look at the status of where visas are, how long it takes to get a visa, it's astounding. The thing is, there are too many jobs and not enough visas because employers here want the labor. And there, it's detrimental both to people here and to people coming over to work, because people coming to work can be taken advantage of, because if they don't do what the employer wants them to, or if they're not willing to work for whatever the pay that they're given, then the employer can threaten to call immigration. I don't know that they actually take jobs from Americans. You know, there's all kind of statistics you can read, from the Pew Hispanic Trust to different immigration sites. You can read about jobs, but they lower the income of those particular jobs. They lower that level of income. And as you probably, you know, been widely publicized in Alabama, when so many people left the state, both unauthorized residents and people who were here legally and citizens, Hispanics left Alabama because they didn't want to be harassed, and they went to other states. And the farmers were losing their crops because there was no one to harvest it. They tried to get Americans that would come and work, and they wouldn't last. They would have better working conditions, higher wages, you know, if they would legalize or make available visits, maybe not legalize the people, but make available visiting visas, because most of the people we encounter don't want to live here. They want to work here, support their family, and go back home. And if you look at this website, go to the government website and look under visas, and it gives the categories. There are like 5 different categories where you can apply for a visa for a family member. And there, you have to wait until all the visas that have been processed since 1992 or 1995, depending on what your relative, whether it's a sister or a parent, whether that parent is a citizen or whether that parent is a legal resident. So there are not enough visas. And whether, not that they need to be made citizens, but there needs to be some way for workers to come and work and take the jobs that are needed.
We have a caller waiting on line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Dr. Norma Price.
Dr. Price, yeah. Instead of building an Iron Curtain or a Berlin Wall, isn't there some mode of developing, what would you call it, employment hostels where people can come directly to the border looking for work, and where American employers know what kind of person they want so that they can match up right at the border without getting dehydrated or I can think of a few other things that can happen besides being shot by some wonderful American vigilante.
I think that's an excellent idea. And I think the thing that we need to do is contact our congresspeople and our senators.
And also talk about it more out loud. I'm ashamed of this country's involving itself in various things, all of which are objectionable, and nobody or very few people, I consider myself nobody talking about it.
Thank you so much for that, for speaking out on that behalf. We need to. We need to stand up and speak out.
I'd like to hear more of it out loud.
Yes.
Thank you a lot.
Thank you for your call. Appreciate it. And again, if you have a comment or question, do give us a call here at WILL AM 580. We're also, of course, heard on FM 90.9 HD3. And as with the time change, there may be some of you who have a very good reception on AM for the whole program. Others may want to switch to FM 90.9 with the time change. So that's HD3 if you have an HD radio. We're also heard, of course, online anywhere around the world at will.illinois.edu/AM. You can hear this program live, and you can also find archives of previous programs at that website. That's will.illinois.edu/AM.
Steve, one thing, the last caller, there's a book that I think is very open about immigration, and it's not one-sided to the left or to the right. It's called Let Them In by Jason Riley, and he's a journalist with, I believe, the Wall Street Journal, and maybe one of the editorialists of the Wall Street Journal. But he says he doesn't give much slack to either side, as far as by either side I mean politically, the extreme right or extreme left. But he says that, you know, the problem is there are not enough visas. There are too many people who need work, too many employers who want to hire them, and there are not enough visas for them to work. I think the last caller's idea is excellent.
Dr. Price, when you talk about 200 people last year who died trying to get into this country, usually to find work, what is motivating them to risk all that? And how bad is the situation where they live that they would do that?
It's desperation. You know, the need to support their family, the fact that they can't get work where they live. I won't drag out this story, but there, one of the stories that points this out is a man who was from Guatemala, and he was making $2.50 a day. And he had to go 3 days from his home to the coffee plantation for work to earn that. So he was coming to the United States where he picked lettuce and earned $8 an hour and was able to send money home for his family. There was one man that from Mexico, who, when I talked to him, I found out that he was, I said, you know, what kind of work did you do in Mexico? And he said he was a mechanic. Well, I was really surprised that he had a trade and still couldn't support his family. And he said he only made $10 a day, and his family had incurred some medical bills, and he couldn't, you know, he couldn't pay them on the salary that he was making. So it's we talk to people. Sometimes we'll encounter people who we'll meet them in Nogales, Mexico, and they'll say they're going back home, that it was much harder than they expected. But most of the people who do get returned to Mexico want to try again to cross because of the desperation of needing to support their family.
Are there other medical doctors who are volunteers with the Samaritans?
Yes, there are. We have several doctors. We have quite a few nurses, some physical therapists, quite a few people who've been trained in wilderness first responder, and EMTs. And so we always have, we try on every trip into the desert to have a medical person, a Spanish speaker, and usually a third or fourth person. We always have at least two and sometimes four people going out at a time.
And how often do the Samaritans go out into the desert?
We go out every day.
Every day.
And then, as I mentioned, in the summer, the people in at the camp, you know, so that there are people out there as well.
So how often are you in one of those vehicles?
I try to go once a week.
How long How long are you out?
We usually leave in the summer. We usually leave at 6 in the morning, sometimes earlier, depending on, you know, it's nothing fixed. If the group wants to go out at 7, that's fine. And then in the winter, we do usually start about 7. And we're usually out until mid-afternoon. Sometimes we're back at 1 o'clock, sometimes 3 or 4. It, you know, depends on what, if we encounter problems or not. We don't see as many people on the highways as we used to. When we first started in Samaritans, there were a lot of people who would either from injury or illness or being left behind, they would make their way to the road. But the routes have changed, and there's so much militarization along the border and north of the border, helicopters flying over all the time. There are checkpoints on all the roads and border patrol up and down the roads, so that we don't see as many people on the roads as we used to.
How do the military people and the Border Patrol folks that you encounter respond to you?
It varies. Some are very nice and some are very curt and abrupt. That's most of my experience is one or the other. Professional, you know, and they know, I mean, we've been around long enough now that the ones who have been here for a while know that, you know, what we do and that we're not doing anything against the law, and they may or may not, I think they consider us a thorn in their flesh. You know, they would like for us to be out of the way so they could do what they want to do and not have us in the way. But they are usually very professional. Every now and then there's some uncharacteristic rudeness, and every now and then we're surprised at how friendly someone may be.
Are your vehicles identifiable?
Yeah, we have, you know, there's a magnetic sign that you can put on the side of your car. So we lose them occasionally in the back country when we're driving these four-wheel drive roads, and they'll get scraped off by brush and... you know, they're not cheap, and we don't have a lot of money, so we hate to lose them. But recently one of the volunteers found one of the signs that had been lost about 3 weeks before. It's still lying in the middle of the road.
What does the sign say?
It says Samaritans, and it has a red and green cross, I mean a white cross. The sign's red. It has a white cross outlined in green, and it says Samaritans and then Los Samaritanos. Used to, when we would go out, we would call out in Spanish, you know, even though those of us who are not fluent in Spanish have a few phrases, we'd call out Somos Samaritanos, we're Samaritans, and then we realized that they probably wouldn't know, you know, what is a Samaritan. So now we just call out and say we're friends, we're here to help, and, you know, if anybody needs food or water, because, you know, they don't know, if they hear people coming, they don't know whether we're a friend or foe.
And how many people on a typical once a week that you go out for those, that many hours, how many people will you encounter?
Now, in the last couple of years, I may go a couple of weeks and not encounter anyone. And that's how we got started putting out these gallon jugs of water, because we realized people are traveling more at night, and they're traveling in different routes. And so we put the water out so they can find them when they're traveling at night. Initially, when before it became so militarized in the area, we would find people several times a week. And sometimes groups and sometimes single people who had gotten separated from their group and gotten lost. But now we may go several weeks and not find anyone. But we know that they're out there, and we know that the that the water does get used.
Now tell us what that desert is like for people who haven't been there ever or recently.
Well, if you've seen any of the John Wayne movies, the old Western movies, a lot of those were shot here in Arizona. There's in Tucson, there's a film area called Old Tucson, where they shot a lot of Westerns, and it's got those, you know, artificial Western towns, and it's sort of a tourist attraction now. But the tall cactus that have the arms that you see, it's called the saguaro cactus. You know, they're extremely tall, you know, 30 feet high, and have these arms that stick up. That's characteristic of the Sonoran Desert. That's the only place that cactus occurs. And then we have a lot of other cactus that are more ubiquitous and occur other places, too, the prickly pear cactus. It's not sand dunes like you see in the Arabian Desert. You know, it's brush, scrub, some scrubby mesquite trees.
Flat or mountainous?
It's both. Part of the area is very mountainous, and that is the area where people have, I mentioned the routes have changed, and people have moved over into the mountains, and it's more dangerous. It's harder to for them to be seen by the Border Patrol. And whereas, 7-8 years ago, people could get from the border to a road to be picked up. If they really pushed, they could get there in one day. But now it takes 3 days to get from the border to the place that they could be picked up because the other roads are so heavily traveled by Border Patrol and have checkpoints.
We have another
call. So it's
call.
Flat, and then there are mountains as well.
As well. And hot, of course.
Very hot. In the summer, it may get up to 115. But it's not uncommon to be 110.
We have another caller, if they're very quick. Yes, go ahead.
Okay, calling again. Do you have any idea of how the commercial employers like Tyson Chicken and I can think of a couple others, get their factory crews by the bus or truckload or semi-tractor load? That's going back all the way to the Clinton days. And I just want to listen to what you might have to say.
I'm sorry, I didn't get to hear all the questions.
Well, he was saying he wonders how the big employers seem to get migrants, workers, by the busload.
I think they come individually across the border, like the ones we see. And then, you know, they I think it's places like that, like Tyson, like, I'm not saying that's one of them, but those large companies, a friend will, someone who will be working there knows that they need three more people working on this particular assembly line, and they'll contact their people in their village to come. We encounter people not infrequently who say they were told if they could get up here, they had a job. I remember one man we met who said, is there a ranch near here called Florida? And he was looking for, what he was trying to say was Florida. And he had been told if he could get up here, he had a job in Florida. So we know that there's solicitation of their work, but they have to get up here on their own, I think.
Norma Price, we are out of time. Is there a website where people could learn more about the Samaritans?
Yes. Let me give you two websites. One is TucsonSamaritans.org. That's TUCSON, TucsonSamaritans.org. And then No More Deaths, all one word, NoMoreDeaths.org.
TucsonSamaritans.org or NoMoreDeaths.org. I want to thank Norma Price, a physician, former oncology medical doctor, for telling us about her group, the Samaritans, that help unauthorized residents in Arizona. She's one of the co-authors of a book called Crossing with the Virgin, put out by University of Arizona Press. And she referred also to a book she recommends, Let Them In, by Jason Riley from the Wall Street Journal. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Next week, our guest will be Clifford Jackson, an attorney in Hot Springs, Arkansas, who writes very interestingly about being issues of faith and doubt, about being a Christian existentialist or a Christian agnostic. That will be next week, November 20, here on WILL AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD3. And then on November 27, we'll have an archive program with Azuldin Abulaish, a Muslim medical doctor from Palestine, from Gaza, in fact, who wrote a book called I Shall Not Hate after the deaths of three of his children. So the topic is Islam, forgiveness, and peace. That's an archive program from last February. And then later in December, we'll be talking with Amy Frickholm, an author of See Me Naked, a series of interviews on sexuality and faith that's just out. She's a writer for the Christian Century magazine. Again, thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Freestar Bank, Champaign, Ray's Heating and Air Conditioning, Urbana, Prairie Ridge Farm Incorporated, Allerton, and KC Summers, Mattoon. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you. Thank you.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9.